JP, your plan is to head east first and then go north. The east is the easy section. You're traveling kind of with the storms in general. You've got lots of places to land. You've got the best weather reporting. You've got approach looking over your shoulder. However, realistically, if I kind of crank forward in time here, you're going to get to Griffiths in Rome, New York, and be like, still can't go north. You could land, but then your friend has to start driving almost immediately because you've only shaved a couple hours off the trip and took you an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours to get there. So you're probably going to continue east to try and get your friend a little closer. And you're going to end up in, you know, Glen Falls or Schenectady due south of Burlington. And then you're going to stop because you don't want to go further east. Mm-hmm. You've now put yourself, I think, in the worst position to cross the storms going home because you're going perpendicular across their path. And you've got to find a gap where you're going to miss all of those one after the other after the other rather than traveling with them. So you're kind of kicking the can down the road. Do you really expect to get to Burlington with your friend, or is this really just about getting him closer? Isn't this plan going to fall apart, essentially, once you get east?
I essentially think that we will make it to Burlington. I think that's going to be a viable option, and I think we're in a fluid situation. The storms are moving. I am in a moving airplane, and I think this does buy some time as I start to move off toward the east and northeast. I will tell you from the radar pictures here, I think it's entirely doable to get to Burlington even at this point in time. My concern looking at this is to make sure this does not congeal into some kind of linear feature that's going to be tough to transverse. Right now, weaving and dodging, anybody that flies around the state of Florida in the southeast, this is a typical day. This is what we deal with. You look at the rain shafts, you look at the radar, and you kind of see where that correlates, and you just visualize it. And a lot of times, I'll tell you, it looks better in the air than what it looks like on radar. You have to be very cautious with it, but I think it is doable, and you do have some options. If it looks like it is turning into a line as I fly off to the northeast, I'm going to land and tell my friend, hey, go ahead, get the car, and I'm going to wait it out here.
You know, it's at my own risk that I disagree with the meteorologist at the table when it comes to weather, but I'm with you, Dave. I like that northern route better. I have my reasons, but I want to hear yours. What do you think?
Well, I just want to be on the upwind side. You know, I think the forecast is in my favor. The cells are moving quickly to the east. I think our chances of making it all the way to Burlington are excellent. Actually, I think they're good, you know, in any of the first three answers. But the reason that I would be hesitant to go east and then north is that I'm responsible to protect this airplane at all times, even when it's on the ground. And I've had some close calls before where we dodge the storms in the air, but then you land somewhere to wait it out, and it's like the airplane is vulnerable on the ramp then. And hail, lightning, winds, you know, those can get you on the ground too. So I'm going to explain to my friend that there's a chance we won't make it tonight, and there's a chance that he's going to miss getting home. But I think that flying in smooth air toward sunset behind the front, that's just a more attractive option.
Now, John, what do you think about that?
Well, I would break it up into smaller chunks. My first destination would probably be Syracuse and continue to maintain lots of options and outs along the way. Maybe at Syracuse, if it was looking really bad, you could still go north. But if I stay on that I-90 corridor, Syracuse, Griffiths, Schenectady, Albany, and there's lots of little airports along the way that give me opportunities for bailouts and stuff. I have a lot less opportunities up to the north. And there is the stuff in Canada that's heading east, too. The one thing that you definitely do not want to ever do here in a situation like this is go across the Adirondacks directly. And looking at the METARs, it's 32 degrees in Burlington, it's 32 in Syracuse. That's some pretty hot, muggy air. This is in August. It's in the afternoon. The Adirondacks are a thunderstorm factory. I've worked that airspace. I know the area pretty well. And it's almost like a given. And that's, and it's kind of different, to JP's point, about the Florida thunderstorms that just become air mass things with the southwest wind pushing all this moist, unstable air with the lifting of the mountains. It just, it brews them continuously. So I'm for leapfrogging 50 miles at a time and just kind of continually reassessing it.
Well, I like that the strategy for you is really just an airport to airport to airport kind of strategy. Tom?
And that's exactly the strategy that I envision going east. There are more alternatives that way. We don't have long stretches over the as much of the inhospitable terrain. And so I'd do the same thing on the eastbound. I'd be going from airport to airport and reassessing the decision as I go.
Wally, you sound like you're on board with that as well.
I am indeed. Yeah, John used the term leapfrog. I like stepping stones.
Mm-hmm.
I look out to the next stone I can step on and land there if I need to. And as I proceed to that place, I evaluate the next stepping stone. And I think, you know, to your point, Jeff, about sure, you've got to turn north eventually and go through this front, but we're going to be turning north 3 or 4 hours later than now. And therefore, we can evaluate what's happening. Hopefully, it's dissipating. That's what it's supposed to do. And if it does, we'll be able to easily get through. Now, it may not, and we may be stuck, as you point out.
Tom?
Well, going kind of building on what Wally said there, I took a long trip in a Cessna 150 about 6 years ago, halfway across the country. And I saw a lot of thunderstorms out ahead of myself on the depictions. And I developed sort of the philosophy of what I called the miracle of flying slowly. There may be a thunderstorm out there on my radar, but I won't get there until it's gone. And so I can just continue to progress from point to point to point as it blows away from me.
And the Tomahawk is practically an angel at this flying slowly thing. Like that's right.
You guys just want the tailwind. You guys want to go east because you want a tailwind. You want to have a faster ground speed. I get that too.
We'll take that also.
And a bit of a, to help out my passenger too, that also provides more opportunities for them to drive home from places if it comes to that.
Kevin.
I'm heading towards Griffiths like we were talking about. I'm not necessarily going to stop at every airport along the way, but I'd like to have those as options. It's always better to be on the ground, you're wishing in the air, rather than the opposite of that. And I feel like the northern route could put you in a spot where you're in the air and maybe you're wishing you're on the ground and you're kind of painted into a corner because there aren't nearly as many airports, there aren't as many options as far as where you can go. And these thunderstorms that we're talking about, those are relatively easy to be able to pick your way around as necessary. And if you get in a spot where you can't, then there's a lot of airports on the southern route where you can land and cool your heels for a little bit and press on.
But you're in clear air. You've got NexRad for the bigger picture. You've got your eyes. And one thing I will say for the Tomahawk is it has great visibility all the way around. These storms can't sneak up on you and catch you unawares, right, JP? So why do you need that many landing options? A Tomahawk is slow, sure, but it's faster than a thunderstorm moving over the ground.
Right? You know, what I'm looking at, the biggest concern for me and my weather background with this is the static picture to begin with doesn't look very scary. Certainly you want to avoid what you see there, but some of this merging together to become just this mass and cluster of thunderstorms that would not be manageable. So that's why the stepping stones or the leapfrogging works to have these really get out points. And a thing that I see a lot of people do, they start off and they look at a weather picture and they'll make their decision then. Weather is a living, breathing thing, and with that data that you have in the cockpit, it is important to constantly be reevaluating the situation and see how all of this is coming together. And a tip that I would have, the electronic flight bags, whatever vendor you like to use, you're still looking at a rather low-resolution type radar picture compared to what you could get with some other apps that are out there where you could actually look at single site NexRad. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage anyone when you're making those decisions on the ground, and even if you're flying low enough, you can sometimes get these signals to have an app in your iPad or your phone or whatever, where you can see single site NexRad, because I can tell you it's going to look a lot different than what you even see right there in that picture. It's going to be more the resolution, the super high res data is going to help you make that decision better.
But how useful would that be to you? Because for the most part, it's going to be on the ground and you're making at that point really a strategic decision. By the time you even have gotten to the airplane, fueled up, taxied out, launched, it's a different picture.
I think it's something you need to look at on the ground, because I've seen situations where I'm flying with somebody else. They're like, oh, look at this, how terrible this is or whatever. And I'll show them, well, here's what it really looks like. Oh, so you can actually see some of those significant gaps in the storms. But once you're in the air, you are a bit, stuck with what you get because of bandwidth issues that you can't always get this great resolution. But the most wonderful radar that we have really is this is a VFR day, is our eyes, and to be able to look at those thunderstorms and be able to navigate safely around them.
You know, Dave, there's probably no one here at the table who has more time flying all different kinds of airplanes, truly long distances, across all kinds of weather, often with some kind of deadline. A new AOPA airplane has to make it to this paint shop and that avionics shop and something like that. How do you use, personally, the NexRad image in flight to make these kinds of decisions? And let's suppose this was the flight. How are you going to use it between Rochester and Burlington? Kind of brass tacks.
I mean, just to look at big picture sorts of trends, and I think people around the table have put their finger on exactly what they are. Our difference is just, we see the same thing. It's just what our strategy to avoid is going to be.
There are definitely going to be subscribers who have made the choice to send the friend, I'm just going to sit this out, which is perfectly reasonable. But I'm impressed there's not a single person here who has made that choice. Everyone has decided to at least give it a try. And, it's not a table of scofflaws here. So I wanted to pick at that a little bit, why that is a prudent and safe decision. Tom?
Well, strangely enough, this goes back to when I was a high school kid and in college. My father was an airline mechanic, and we were out in Honolulu, and I went to college in Ohio. I did a lot of standby flying back before they invented frequent flyer miles, and you could get standby seats, but you still had to strategize. And one of the things that I learned was from flying standby is never let a flight leave that's going in the approximate direction that you want to go. And you may have to reevaluate after you get there, but it's better to, if there is in general aviation, if there is a safe way to get there as opposed to a viable way when flying with the airline there, if there is a safe way to get in the direction you want to go, go ahead and take it, and then make another choice later, because weather is not static. Weather isn't going to do exactly what the forecast said. And so sometimes just go a couple of hours, sit down and take another look at the picture, but keep going in the direction you want to go.
Yeah. Wally?
I just can't tell you how many times I've started in the morning looking at a picture like this saying, there's no hope. Mm-hmm. And then saying, well, perhaps we can go 100 miles. We're here. Let's just go 100 miles. And arriving at the destination quite easily. So I think it's a worthwhile journey, unless you get stuck at an airport. You might wind up sleeping in the FBO a time or two doing that also.
But, right. Yeah. There's a certain level of risk, if you will, in aviation. So there's the risk of a couch. Okay. Guaranteed for sure. Yeah. John.
No, I was going to echo the other sentiments that it's really not that bad, especially in the early portion of this flight, the Rochester to Griffiths section. It's pretty low terrain. You could do it at 2,500 feet the whole way in the Tomahawk. So you're definitely below the cloud layers. You've got good visibility and lots of outs. And I think that's the key to the whole thing, is you don't want to get into a box canyon of weather that closes in behind or turns around. So that's why I would go back to the stepping stone principle, not necessarily landing at each one of these places, but navigating over or near each one so that you could turn around real quick, because it may not be bad there, but if you look and your route is blocked 50, 75 miles ahead, we might want to just go back and you know, stay near places where we have services.
And I want to stay with that for a moment, because it's your experience that has that you're drawing on to say, yeah, the canyon walls are building. There's going to be a box canyon. This is a low time pilot, two low time pilots, right? What are the things they need to be looking for? If we can, brass tack specifics, how much does a route have to be blocked? How far away to the rain shafts? Because really in the cockpit, that's where the decisions are going to have to be made. And that's the rubber meets the road kind of thing where people have to decide. They called you from Rochester and like, we're going to go east. Any advice? What would you say, John?
Yeah, and that's exactly what I said. I'm sure every one of us as instructors has had a student call, and say, what do you think about this? And I said, well, let me take a look. You know, I'll fire up the computer and we'll talk it through. So you're not there. You're not making a decision for them, but you're a resource that they can bounce some of these ideas off. And very often you'll find that between the two of you, you come up with some kind of plan. And if this was my student who called me in this situation, I'd say, you know, go airport to airport and call me back when you land at each one. And we'll keep talking about this.
Wally.
Well, I think in this scenario, the aspect that encourages me to start is the fact that this whole thing is forecast to decrease rather than increase. Mm-hmm. This is a front end, and the forecasts say it's the thunderstorms are going to be dissipating. So as time goes on, my condition should be getting better.
Okay.
If I'm coming up on a fast-moving cold front with big black storms through it, and they're increasing, that might change the whole picture for me.
So if I can summarize that, you're kind of watching trends, right?
Correct.
If there are more, if the areas between the storms are becoming more numerous, this is a good indication to go. Right, that's right. The trend is what matters.
And we have lots of pictures here with these webcams telling us that, convincing us that those where there are thunderstorms are widely scattered.
Right.
And as far as your question about proximity, it's like being on the upwind side, you know, it's a lot. You can safely get closer on the upwind side than you can on the downwind side.
Tom.
Use the looping feature on the radar depiction and say, are they getting more numerous, less numerous? Are they getting closer together? Are storms building, just popping out of nowhere? Or is it a relatively static picture that's drifting with the wind? And if it's, you know, if you're still in a period where the cells are building, you might be more inclined to wait it out. If it's okay, well, this is the radar picture and the whole thing is drifting this way at 20 knots, then you can say, okay, well, I should be able to easily avoid that.
You know, JP mentioned that the southern route stays mostly in approach airspace, and the northern route, there's this major section that's mostly center airspace. Kevin, this is kind of your corner of the country here. From the pilot's point of view, what can they ask of ATC that would actually be helpful here? Is there anything in particular, or is it more just listening in and expecting that the controller will, you know, moderate returns at this area? Like, how can a pilot use that resource in an effective way?
Really, I think the best resource there, and it's not limited to approach versus center, is PIREPS. And anybody can get those from ATC. And even if they aren't in the system, you can be asking the controller if they've heard PIREPS. And if you don't get an answer, you're like, ask them again. And that could prompt other pilots on frequency to hear you asking that question. And even if the ATC doesn't start going around asking questions of everybody, maybe the other pilots will start speaking up and saying, hey, you know, here I am 15 northwest of Albany, and it's a smooth ride, and it looks good to the northeast from here, but it's much worse to the northwest. Or whatever. The other thing to keep in mind, though, is what ATC has for resources and what they have to work with. And one thing that is really important to know is that ATC does not have lightning strike data. They don't know if a thunderstorm is a thunderstorm or if it's just precip. The only thing they can see is precipitation.
John?
Yeah, and to build on that, it's not how can I say, and not angle discriminated. We don't know where the radar beam is pointing in terms of lowest angle or highest, and approach radar just it kind of scans to a fairly high azimuth. So it sees a lot more than weather radar does. It sees everything. There's some interpretation there too. It may be showing more than you're really seeing. It's more like your composite picture rather than the lowest tilt. But the other thing is, one of the control's responsibilities is to advise of weather returns. That's a primary responsibility or primary service. So just by talking to the controller and getting PIREPs and getting weather advisors, they're required to advise you when they see moderate or extreme weather.
Let's pick up a little bit on that tilt, because that came up here as well, the composite image versus low tilt, which for most of us is only going to be available on the ground because we are flying with ADS-B weather. It is available through Sirius if anybody has that subscription. I'm wondering how useful people find that difference. Is it something you're looking at on the ground? And for anyone who's flying with SiriusXM weather, is it something that you use in the air? JP?
Yeah, I use it, and I think everyone should if you're going to be flying in lower altitudes where we do with a lot of these GA airplanes. I think it gives you a better idea of the actual footprint of that storm. I usually call that composite, that big picture, I call it blobo vision, because it looks like it blobs. And I think you should be utilizing that lower feature, because you don't want that full, 19.5 degree volume scan data piled on top of there.
Do you know the altitude roughly that's happening? Obviously, this is an angle, not a perfect altitude, so it's going to depend on where it's scanning from and that kind of thing. But what block of air are you seeing returns from when you're looking at lowest tilt?
Well, that depends on what you're looking at that with. If you're looking at it with some of the apps out there where you're actually able to pick the NEXRAD site, you can determine the farther you are away from that radar, how far that radar is looking up. If you're looking, for example, in our area here, if you're looking at a Portland, Maine NEXRAD, and we're looking at New Hampshire here, we're going to be looking at several thousand feet up in the air. What you don't have the ability to do, and it's with Sirius or with ADS-B, whatever way you're getting that weather, you don't have the ability to choose the NEXRAD site. It just kind of pulls it all in there together. So you really don't know how high up you're looking, because you're not individually choosing that NEXRAD site.
Dave?
Sirius has a wonderful ability to take slices, take altitude blocks and show you the radar image at those blocks. And I got to think that they would be helpful to the pilot in this scenario, because the blob of vision point, it's true that it's like, if there are storms at high altitude and there are no rain shafts coming down, it may be a perfectly reasonable decision to fly under those. But, in this scenario, I would, late in the afternoon with the dissipating thunderstorms, that's exactly the time that you wouldn't want to go under these shelves.
Right. And that was a question I wanted to bring up, is you're talking about staying visual and you've got a bunch of storms that are potentially high above you. What's the strategy to make sure you don't wander in your Tomahawk right underneath something just when there's a huge downflow of air? And we all know we have a stellar climb rate, right? So, this could be a real issue.
Yeah, I'm looking for rain shafts and visualizing those. A lot of times, and a strategy I use, I know in this scenario, we're VFR, but I can tell you many times I have canceled IFR to go VFR so I can make sure I stay visual and can see everything, because to me it is downright scary to be in and out of clouds relying on delayed weather information and not knowing what may be on the other side. So I get a lot of students say, I'm waiting to get my instrument rating so I can fly in this kind of weather, and I tell them, Instrument rating is not to fly into thunderstorms. In right. fact, sometimes you may be better visual to go around those thunderstorms. And that's what we're doing here. See and avoid. See and avoid thunderstorms the best we can. And there's plenty of opportunities to do this with this type of weather. We're just concerned, I think, for me, this turning into something that's less manageable, where you see a lot of cell mergers there, and it's just harder to navigate around.
Wally?
As a young co-pilot a long time ago in piston airliners, we used precisely that same technique. The captain would tell me to file at the minimum en route altitude. And we, even though we had radar on the airplane, most of those captains wanted to see those rain shafts, and we would work our way around through some pretty rough lines sometimes doing precisely that. So there's nothing better than your eyes.
One of the stealth factors in here that could be overlooked is just the wind. It's so easy to focus on the thunderstorms because they're thunderstorms and they're painted in pretty colors all over the screen. You actually got to look to see what the winds are. And this is a pretty gusty day here in a fairly low wing loading airplane. That could easily get overlooked, and these pilots could launch and find themselves actually just bouncing around so much that it's uncomfortable or hard to focus on things. I want to take that a step further. These are a pair of low time pilots, right? The pilot is in what I'll call like the 300-hour danger zone. Just enough confidence. And they just flew all the way across the country. They're like one with this airplane. How does that factor in to the decision making here? Are these pilots particularly vulnerable, or are they actually like in the great spot to be making this kind of decision? Dave.
I would just say it's not particular to low time pilots, but it's the last leg. On these long trips, it's always the first leg and the last leg that to me seem the most precarious. You know, that's true regardless of a pilot's experience level. So, you know, when I'm about to finish a long trip, you know, and it's the last leg, I always give myself a little pep talk, you know, before as I get in the plane, to just, you know, be extra wary, you know, really pay attention this time, because, you know, if something, some crazy curveball is going to come, this is the time.
Tom.
Well, I agree completely with that. I was at about 4,400 total time with an ATP and all my instructor certificates when I flew that 150 from Atlanta back to Wichita. And I was trying to get that flight done in a complete day, in a single day. I got within 50 miles of home when I had to turn around and fly almost 45 minutes back to the first reasonable alternate. And I was just very tired. I was looking at the minimum elevation figures and trying to figure out, well, where is the tower in this quadrant that makes that minimum elevation figure what it is? And then I decided, you know, this is the sort of stuff I write about. So it's not just a low time pilot. It's the fact that you're close to home.
JP.
Yeah, I think you tend to suffer the most from get there itis on that last leg. You made it across the country. I'm going to complete my mission. So I think you're particularly vulnerable, and it doesn't really matter what level of time and even experience you have with that. So I think that's the real danger here with that last leg. And there's a lot of psychology that goes into this. I mean, I've sat around, and even with years of weather experience, sat there and just looking for ways to make something work, knowing that it won't work. And I have to check that and say, you know what? I'm using emotion to make these decisions and not logic. This is a bad idea, or this is a good idea.
Or in between, right?
Yeah.
This is a reasonable idea. But it's tempting to talk yourself into it because the emotional side has already made its decision. Like, and your friend said here, he really, really wants to finish, you know, all the way across the country in your own new airplane, and you're going to drive the last way home. Like, that is rough. Sure. Wally.
I think that could even be a greater danger for an experienced pilot, because we have more ways of trying to make things work.
Right.
Right. Justifications. We can, right. We can justify just about anything.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, there are a couple other things I want to pick apart in here that could be useful to people listening. Part of what set this chain in motion was the overnight in Ohio. They got stuck because of fog the next morning. But that was a diversion because of weather that day. For the people who've traveled long distances, is that something you think about? Or if you, it's the end of the day, you're probably going to be overnighting. There's a bigger picture here. What goes into that diversion decision? Because it's easy to be like nearest airport. But, you know, what are the stealth factors that you're going like, actually, before I commit to this, what do I need to look at to set the cards in motion for the next day of flight? JP.
Well, I will say just when I pick a diversion, and this is just from experience, I've already kind of decided some of those points along the way in the flight planning. And I do pick a place that has some level of maintenance facility. I think that is... you have a potential to really get burned. Sometimes we're looking for the cheapest gas. All of us really do that, but make sure you have some level of maintenance, because something relatively simple could keep you stuck there or could become very expensive if you have to get a mechanic to some odd place.
Dave.
Yeah, and no guarantees, you know, but it's like I'm always looking at the TAF. You know, before you land at your alternate, look at the TAF for the next morning.
Wally.
And if you have if you're planning on an early morning departure from your alternate, don't pick an airport in a valley by a river like I did one time.
That sounds like the voice of experience here, Wally.
We had to get home. We're going to get home early in the next morning. I'm just going to land here and we'll stay tonight and we'll leave first thing in the morning. Yeah. Not.
Yeah, it's exactly what happened to these pilots. John.
Yeah, which it is very possible here after. You know, if they wind up getting stuck in Albany or Schenectady or something, you're right along the river. That all that rain went through the night before, the air is saturated in the morning. And but the other point I was going to make about diversions is looking for ground services also. You know, you want to find a place that's got either hotels or crew cars or something like that. And what I do sometimes is even call ahead. To another airport, you know, you talk to the FBO and find out that there's not a convention in town and every hotel room is sold out, you know, that kind of thing. So even if you don't use that place as a diversion, you know, you got kind of a safe haven there, or there's no point in stopping there if there's no services available. So a little bit of pre-planning on that. And I think I would do that on this, you know, before I leave Rochester, I'd probably call two or three of the FBOs and just see what the situation's like.
My pre-planning is a tent and a sleeping bag in the back of this, in the back of the plane.
You always need something, right? Like the plan B, the plan C. You know, I like something you said there, John, about calling ahead to two or three of the FBOs along the way, because as soon as you lock into, okay, here's my diversion airport, it's not really a diversion anymore, right? Because that's the airport you're going to, and now that's where the rental car is, and that's where the hotel reservation is, and now you've kind of taken some of your flexibility off the table. And that seems like the big thing about the scenario. No matter what route any of us are taking, this is not really a go, no-go kind of situation, because there's so many variables and it's such a dynamic situation. It's really kind of a rolling decision along the way. And that's what seems in common about this. Now, this is real weather, and actually, as it played out, any one of the choices would have gotten you home by about sunset. But there is no way that you could have known that, and any other possibility could have been true. Any of them could have boxed you in. So it's worth it, as long as you have a plan, to take a shot. Just make sure you've got a really solid plan. If the trends start to say you need to exercise, you're out.